From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. After what was likely the most acrimonious campaign in history, Donald Trump has been president for less than 3 weeks, and his presidency has, again, been faced with unprecedented acrimony. For more on that, we spoke with Danny Haifong, whose piece this week at blackagendareport.com is entitled "The Undressed Empire, An Analysis of the First Weeks of the Trump Era." We spoke with him via Skype from Boston Sunday.
I don't think in my short life I've ever seen the beginning of a U.S. presidency be filled with just so much tension and you know, the large crisis of legitimacy that we saw occur during the 2016 elections has definitely leaked into the Trump era, where, you know, Donald Trump has attempted to make good on all of his campaign promises by executive order, in my opinion, in an attempt to solidify his administration in the midst of some pretty thoroughgoing opposition, both inside and outside of Washington. And, you know, a lot has happened with this so-called quote-unquote Muslim ban, the restriction of migration through the use of, you know, quote-unquote extreme vetting of green card and visa holders from seven different countries, which we know have not only been under attack by prior administrations through, you know, endless warfare, but also through, you know, this being a logical policy addition to what had already been occurring for, you know, towards so-called quote-unquote refugees who have been forcibly displaced from their homes, from their home countries. So we see a lot happening, especially in regards to the Democratic Party attempting to really spearhead a movement against the Trump administration and create a scenario where they can once again, you know, ascertain some legitimacy in the face of what is probably the most dire crisis of imperialism that I think, you know, we've ever seen. Like, I don't know any other period where we could say that the Democratic Party would literally go up on, you know, corporate national television on CNN like Nancy Pelosi did and basically call the Democratic Party a capitalist party and you know, shoot down a young person, probably a Sanders supporter of that milieu, and just say, yeah, you may say that 51% of your age group doesn't like capitalism anymore, but we are all for capitalism. I think that just speaks volumes to this moment that we are in, where both parties are in complete disarray still. And you know, the corporate media is in this frenzy trying to make it look like it's Steve Bannon or even Donald Trump himself who hold all of the cards. But when presidents hold all of the cards, it's usually because there's consensus in Washington, and I just don't see it.
You know, I mean, I just am bewildered every day, like in ways I would never think possible, you know, a year ago, by some of the most outrageous stuff that's going on in the context of what you describe. We have this, you know, Tony Montero describes it as perhaps, you know, being on the cusp of an epical shift, like, as in the, you know, the epic of end of feudalism and the beginning of capitalism, you know, that those two epics. I look at almost the entire media landscape in this country, and I'm including everything from CNN, MSNBC, New York Times, Washington Post, and Democracy Now, and a host of others. They have one narrative. Trump is a fascist. The people behind him, the basket of deplorables, are, you know, ignorant, racist, white working class people who, in a lot of people's mouths, deserve exactly the situation that they're in. And on the other side, those people are condemned as leftists and liberals. That's what comes out of Fox's mouth, you know, out of Newt Gingrich's mouth, out of, you know, that part of the media universe. Again, like the people with the red uniforms, you know, spouting information fractals, if you can call that information, but talking points at the ones with blue and vice versa. That's what our media is at this point in time. And that's where this public discussion around all these really deep issues and, you know, both multiple crises on the one hand and an apparent sea change or an attempted sea change in policy on the other.
Yeah, there's definitely a reconfiguration going on within the two-party corporate establishment. That's really reflected in the corporate media. And, you know, there's this real attempt by both, you know, sections of the ruling class in this country to completely obliterate any legitimate conversation on the real hard and critical questions that were raised before Trump was inaugurated. The hard questions of why so many people decided that what they really wanted was an improvement in their economic condition. You know, one out of every two people in the United States could be considered impoverished, could be considered in poverty. That's a deep change from 40, 50 years ago. Why there is all of these trillions, you know, of dollars going out the window for bank bailouts and endless warfare. These were the critical questions that were really on people's minds, whether it was through, you know, direct conscious knowledge of it or whether it was just through their day-to-day lives, you know, being so frustrating right now. Yeah. I mean, I can feel it just day-to-day walking around in my neighborhood, at my job, that these are the things that people are really thinking about. But the narrative that is being peddled in this, fake conflict between the Democrats and the new Trump administration and GOP, order in the White House is all geared towards creating a new narrative that can legitimize the so-called opposition party to the Trump administration, the Democratic Party. That's what all of what's been happening has been about.
Yeah, right.
You know, there's all these protests around the immigration executive order, and then here comes the, you know, court system to bail us out and make it look like the Democratic Party has scored some sort of victory, when in reality, all of the policies that the Democratic Party pursued over the last 8 years under Obama has left a deep infrastructure that allows things like mass migration to continue to plague people in the seven countries that Trump supposedly targeted.
Yeah, which, by the way, I mean, that's the list of seven countries is a list he inherited.
Exactly.
He doesn't even name five of them in the executive order because all he had to do was refer to existing statute. And the two he did name had been on the list since Jimmy Carter created it in 1979. So, you know, they call it Trump's Muslim ban. It isn't Trump's list. It isn't it has nothing to do with Muslims. It talks about real estate, geography, from this country, that country, that country. Seven of the 50 Muslim majority countries are on it. The largest one, Indonesia, is not on it. You know, the next five largest ones aren't on it. And then I think that's right, or four of the next five aren't on it. And it's not a ban. It doesn't ban anyone. You have a regime of what, compared to any other country pretty much in the world, what could be called extreme vetting already. That was the condition on January 19th, 2017, when the president who deported more immigrants than any other president in the history of the United States, we're going back to 1789, 1795, wherever you want to start, when he left office after deporting more people than anyone else ever did, that was the condition of the law then, extreme vetting. Trump adds, by executive order, an additional level of review in effect for 90 days that so far has cost people a few extra hours. And it becomes Trump's Muslim ban. And when you raise the fact that, well, it's none of those, People go crazy on you. I got kicked off a radio station in Spokane, Washington, because they say, did I defend Trump without any counter narrative? You go to their Facebook page, is KYRS, and their whole page is attacking Trump, but there's no counter narrative in the 30 minutes that CPR News was on there. It's amazing to me what's going on. It's much more troubling than any of the things that I've seen happen with the administration, as troubling as some of that stuff is.
Exactly. I mean, what we're seeing is that it's not profitable to try to support independent political thought and action. It's more profitable to inspire fear, and inspire a fear that is ultimately paralyzing. You know, we can, none of these, the corporate media isn't going after the GOP for proposing a national right to work legislation. They're not going after the GOP for their continued support, you know, before the Trump administration, for a lot of what the Obama administration did. There's none of that going on. But what we're seeing is the familiar narrative that, you know, whenever the Democrats are no longer the victorious party, there's this fake conflict that is, you know, rehashed and revived, that ultimately only benefits the, you know, the capitalist ruling class in this country that sees, and I still think that this is true, that sees Trump as only as good as the policies that he promotes that benefits them. And then everything else that he does, and everything about him, really, from his personality to his unpredictability to some of his policy proposals, all of those things, you know, are anathema and not palatable to managing the multiple crises on the military, political, and economic spheres. And so what I see is deep divisions in Washington that need to be exploited by independent political organization in order for us to begin to reach out to and organize working class people, you know, people who are really suffering right now, who are going to continue to suffer in the midst of this deep division in Washington. And, you know, it's a squandered opportunity that will ultimately lead to just, you know, more years of, you know, of the same, same struggle, and
some of it's amazing. I mean, look at the in everything. You've got the proposed Secretary of Education, for example. Trump's comes out of the charter school group that want to privatize public education. So who leads the attack? Chuck Schumer, who didn't have a problem with Arne Duncan, who comes out of exactly the same school, who Obama appointed at the beginning of his administration, and who stayed there for most of it. I think he left finally in 2013. And they're putting Cory Booker out front, and that's exactly what he did in Newark.
Yeah. Oh, and he is of, and Glenn Ford talks about this. He's of the same class as Betsy DeVos and her, you know, desire to use private schools as the means to shift federal funds to, and, you know,
except he actually did it. She only advocates for it. He actually did it. He was a mayor in Newark for what, 8 years or whatever, and that's exactly what he did.
Most right wing, most right wing alliance of in the consortium of corporations, hedge funds, and investors that were pushing this. Not de facto segregation through charter schools, but you know, concrete segregation through private school vouchers. That's exactly.
And then you point out this in the article. Obama bombed 5 of the 7 countries on this list that we're talking about over 26,000 times, and gave billions in U.S. tax dollars to the al-Qaeda forces that laid waste to Libya, Syria, and the region at large, like Yemen, for example.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And we have to remember that under, you know, Trump's short reign, what we saw was a raid, in Yemen that killed Anwar al-Awlaki's daughter. But it was Obama that killed Anwar al-Awlaki and his son.
Right.
So, you know, it shows that a mere change of face can't really change a lot of the foundational aspects of U.S. imperialism.
Well, they bombed al-Qaeda, which is a policy shift. That's the salient point to me, is that before, what we were doing is providing AWACS air cover for the Saudis to bomb the people of Yemen while the al-Qaeda was attacking them on the ground, And now mm-hmm. suddenly we said, no, we're not doing that, and bombed Al-Qaeda.
Exactly. It'll be interesting to see, you know, how this will all play out. I know that Putin and Trump are supposed to meet soon, have their personal meeting. And I know that there's been a lot of contradictions, let's just say, in
for sure.
you know, within Trump's administration, just given the deep divisions that exist within it. You know, there's this drive to kind of bait Iran, but at the same time normalize relations with Syria, and at the same time try to get friendly with Russia. And in all of that will come into deep deep conflict, given that you can't really have friendly relationships with Russia and decide to bomb Iran or, you know, provoke Iran in any sort of way. We'll see where it all goes. And I think there's this continuity that just isn't present in this era as there was in prior administrations, this continuity of, endless regime change wars abroad that the Republicans and Democrats waged during the Obama period, and relative peace, you know, social peace in the United States. There was no protest against it. But now we see a lot of unrest around the Trump administration's mere executive order. Some of the things that the Trump administration are proposing, I would argue that the military state does not, does not see as the right move at this moment. Like, I know that Syria was a big chess piece in making Iran weak enough in order to destabilize it. You know, so there's a certain plan in place that the Trump administration, I don't think, is willing to follow. And it only remains to be seen how that really plays out in this struggle that's going on.
But yeah, you point out that there's all these nested contradictions. And Iran, in my view, is one of them. You've got him, you know, chest thumping on the one hand, and he was doing that during the campaign too. The Iran deal was terrible. Mm-hmm. Now he's like, we're going to teach you a lesson, and then these sanctions, which really aren't much. And on the other hand, the phone call with Putin, when you're talking about, you know, teaming up to fight ISIS and Al-Qaeda in Syria, you're also talking about allying with Iran. Because Iran and Russia and Syria are fighting ISIS and Al-Qaeda in Syria. And so if you're going to join that fight, you're shoulder to shoulder with Iran. So that's one of the contradictions. And people don't look at the actual things on the ground when they look at these things. And it's so riddled with contradictions. And yet people are so willing to address things at the level of the apparent, without even probing the essential, that the discussion is meaningless.
Exactly. I mean, individuals can say whatever they want, and Trump can say whatever
right.
he wants.
Right.
His cabinet, you know, his national security advisor, who ultimately had a history of being relatively friendly with Russia after he retired, versus, you know, what he's saying about Iran right now. Like, he could, you know, that. He can say these things, but, you know, in order to have friendlier relations with Russia, unless Russia pulls a big political move toward the United States and away from China, Iran, and countries that it's had to align itself with for mere survival against U.S. imperialism, unless it pulls a big shift like that, which, again, is the abstract, and we, you know, I don't see that happening concretely and that being in Russia's interest. So how this will play out is, you know, is going to be pretty interesting, because what we have on the ground here in the United States is, you know, a pretty deep problem where the majority of the conversation is happening in the abstract. It's happening in a morass of talking points and headlines and clickbait, but the real concrete issues and policies that have to be looked at are ultimately being ignored, and for the most part, you know, the actual conditions on the ground. I had a friend yesterday ask me about what's actually going on in countries like Somalia and Syria, and, you know, these places that the executive order ultimately named. Like, what's going on there? Because, you know, I don't even know why so many people are being displaced. And I think that's true for a lot of people. A lot of people just don't know what's going on around the world for a long time they've been lied to. They've been told that, you know, there's all of these insurgencies and revolutions in Libya and Syria, when in fact it was their government that was sponsoring terrorism in order to destabilize the entire region. And so here we are now in an era where Trump has destabilized things in a lot of ways inside of Washington, and we're still kind of stuck in the same, you know, in the same predicament.
Yeah. Yeah. In terms of destabilization, starts with the, you know, with him winning the Republican primary, with the entire Republican leadership, you know, arrayed against him. You know, he beat the, I remember doing an interview back in 2015 with foreign media, one in particular with First Channel in Russia, that, you know, they were posing it as a you know, a pair of you know, imperial presidency candidates. It was, you know, the dynasties, the Bush versus Clinton dynasties, because it seemed a shoo-in that Jeb Bush was going to get the nomination. This is back in the summer of 2015, and
right.
and it made, you know, sense to me too. You saw, you know, Ted Cruz, the Marco Rubio, you know, a few others, you know, they get lifted up for a minute and down, and Trump just whooped their butts. And the entire party has been radically changed. And what really happened, of course, is that the position of the electorate towards the, you know, original organizing principles of the party, or the previous organizing principles of the party around abortion and, you know, gay rights and all this stuff, they threw that over because they needed a job. And the one guy that said, "I'll get you a job," they said, "I'm voting for him. I don't care what he thinks about abortion or gay marriage or anything else. I want a job. I need a job." He said he's going to keep Social Security. He said he's going to do something with my health care, because Obamacare is not helping me. You know, I have to pay $800 a month. I have a $5,000 deductible, et cetera, et cetera. Those things motivated voters in the Republican Party for the first time maybe since the 1960s. And
exactly.
That is part of what the wrecking was. And then he won the election, which, of course, I don't think I know five people who thought that was even possible.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And we see all these big demonstrations against Trump's executive orders. And what I've noticed about them is that they're not really bringing in a lot of the working class who were terribly dissatisfied with their conditions and decided that there was three ways to go. Either Sanders was going to win the Democratic Party nomination, but he was crushed. There was the way of just not showing up at all, which is what a lot of people did. And then there was the way of voting for Trump in order to see something change. We know that there are a lot of people who thought that, you know, something is going to change here. Maybe I don't believe a lot of the things he says. Maybe I don't believe that he's going to get rid of the Affordable Care Act or the Obamacare, you know, but I'm going to do it. I'm going to vote for him because there are these pressing issues that I have in my life that no other corporate politician is speaking to. And that's what's not being investigated, is why are we in this moment in the first place?
Right.
Because if we can understand that, then we know who we need to talk to and who we need to organize with, who we, you know, and what are the practical issues and positions on the ground that we need to address in order to, you know, in order to really build a movement that's viable enough to combat just this vicious onslaught against any critical, you know, analysis, any left, quote unquote, wing analysis of the current period. Because, you know, the assault is real. I mean, we have Chuck Schumer out here crying. This guy, you know, Madeleine Albright saying she's going to, you know, register as Muslim. You know, these are people that are responsible for the death of millions and for the impoverishment of the majority of the U.S. population. They're not, you know, they're not genuine. But what we're seeing is a complete reconfiguration of the two parties in the era of Trump, in an attempt to, you know, I think eventually get rid of the guy so business as usual can really continue. Because I don't think these conflicts inside of Washington can you know, can really hold, especially with an economic crisis coming. You know, it's coming soon. A collapse in the economic system is coming. Yeah. I don't think that they would, you know, unless they can lay it on Trump, I don't think that the current state of Washington is capable of managing what would come after that.
And finally, the inevitable aftermath of this collapse is going to be further political instability. You know, it's been my opinion or observation from where I sit that there's been a slow-moving attempted coup against the current elected president, which is a statement of fact, and the exacerbation of the conditions of people with another economic collapse, I see as perhaps being enabling of that. You know, what do we do? I mean, you're talking about how, you know, Trump is just another step in the, continuing heightening of contradictions in the U.S. between the ruling elite and the rest of us. So what do we do as this happens? Do we encourage a coup? Do we defend the constitutional order against a coup? Or do we set up a workers' republic? And how do we do that if it's that?
Well, I'm a socialist, and I believe that we need a revolution in order to, you know, have a state controlled and managed by workers themselves. And we're pretty far away from that at this moment, just given the level of organization of working class and oppressed people, and also just the general crisis of the system producing such, a difficult terrain to operate in at this time. However, I think in order to sort of build the blocks toward that scenario, we need to be thinking about independent political organization. We need to be thinking about, well, you know, regardless of what we think of whether we need to be inside of these protests or not, you know, genuine radical and revolutionary organizers in this period have to be thinking about, well, what are the core and concrete demands that people, you know, especially working people in this country, really want to see? And how do we then go out with those demands and begin to organize at the local, at the national level, a campaign that could have many different facets to it, grassroots, electoral, whatever. But at the end of the day, what it's going to have to comprise of is this program of the working class. And I don't think that there's ever been a time in my life, short lifetime, you know, I've only been around 26 years, but you know, my lifetime, where there's been an opportunity for such a program to take hold. You know, I think that there's actually is a lot of opportunity out there right now, and there's in this big and desperate attempt to to concoct this narrative that's coming out of the corporate media, it's coming out of the Democratic Party. This fear, it's really profitable for the media, but also it's really convenient for the Democratic Party, who is seeing its constituents becoming lost and becoming detached from its grips, because ultimately the Democratic Party cannot offer the things that working class people want, that oppressed people want, that, you know, the black community wants. It can't do that, and it won't do that. So here we are, and I think we need to start thinking about this independent political program and wielding it in a manner that, you know, where we can actually start having these conversations about how do we act in such a chaotic moment.
Yeah. Danny Haifong is a regular contributor to blackagendareport.com. His latest offering, The Undressed Empire, an analysis of the first weeks of the Trump era. Danny, thank you very much.
Thank you, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.